This is our Paranormal Afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Krista Gorman about her book, I Died and Learned How to Live. Krista suffered a cardiopulmonary arrest and died while in labour with her daughter. During the 8 minutes she was without a detectable heartbeat, her consciousness transitioned into what we call the afterlife. She is an active member of the International Association of Near-Death Studies and has presented at their annual conferences.
Welcome to...
Hi there, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Oh, hi Simon, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So we're going to be talking about your book, I Died and Learned How to Live. And this is regarding your near-death experience. So could you tell us, how did it start?
My experience occurred in the year 2000, and I was in labor with my daughter, and my labor was induced. So that requires medication to actually start the contractions, and the contractions are therefore normally abnormally strong. So it's this artificial contraction that's occurring fairly regularly. I had gone for about 15 hours without dilating enough to be able to start pushing, you know, to actually deliver her. And so there are risks involved with that. And so the decision was made after her heart rate dropped to 60 on the monitor. That's actually the cutoff for an emergency C-section because it indicates that the baby is in distress. So I knew when I had just graduated from my physician associate training program 3 weeks before this, and I was watching the monitor, and I knew as soon as I saw that, because I couldn't feel the contractions, I had had an epidural, and I knew that I would be going in for a C-section very quickly. And sure enough, the nurse midwife who was handling the delivery up until then, or handling the labor up until then, came in and said, I need to put an internal monitor on the baby. We have to take you in for C-section. I said, yes, I know. So she was putting the monitor on Maggie's head and scalp. And what that is it's a metal corkscrew that is literally screwed into the tissue in the fontanelle area to monitor the baby's vital signs between then and the actual C-section. And they say, you know, in my training, they taught, oh, the baby doesn't feel it. But what must have happened with Maggie is that she did feel it, and she reflexed and kicked. And she must have kicked so hard that amniotic fluid was pushed into my bloodstream, the maternal bloodstream, which is, it's not supposed to mix. My body saw it as foreign and started to form little microclots. And this all happened extremely rapidly. The nurse midwife was down putting the monitor on. I started to have fluttering in my chest and having trouble breathing. And I turned to my mom, who was sitting to my left, and I said, I'm having trouble breathing. And the nurse that was standing there just jumped into action. She got my mom out of there. She pulled me on my left side, stuck an oxygen mask on my face, and I could they were calling a code blue as I was wheeled out of the room because I had just passed out. And I recall the sort of feeling in the hallway as they pushed me out the door. I was in the hall and I was trying to suck breath in through my mouth, and it was like trying to suck air through a teeny tiny little straw. And I just couldn't get any more. And my vision, I just started to sort of pass out, and I felt this peace come over from up above and behind me and come around to the front of me. And it was just such a feeling of peace. And then the next moment of awareness was I could see I was Krista. I was like who I know myself to be sort of in my head. And I was looking down at what I didn't know it was my body, and I didn't know it was a body. I didn't have any name for it. I was looking down at the scene below that was going on, and there was a body on the table and there were people around it, though I didn't know that those were called people. I didn't have any frame of reference for anything earthly. I was completely outside of my personality, my past. I didn't know that I had been a human. I didn't even know what a human was. I was just pure consciousness. And I was watching this go on, and I saw dark, like little dots. I call it particulate matter. It was come racing up from the body below to where my vision was. And it sort of just surrounded where my vision was in this loose undulating kind of static cloud. And I kind of looked around it in kind of wonder. And I looked back down and I saw the doctor had something in a blue sort of drape or towel or something. And I saw someone step into the doorway and then stop for a second and then step up to the edge of the bed I was on. And they handed this thing in the blue towel to someone at my right shoulder, who then took it and turned around very quickly. And I was getting curious about it. I wanted to see, you know, I wanted to know what was going on. So I sort of floated around to the other side of the room, which would have been my left side. And there was somebody who was doing something there too. Another physician. And they were putting a catheter in my chest, threading a catheter into my chest. And I was becoming more, the feeling of curiosity was growing. And the overarching feeling was sort of this detached, neutral sort of feeling. I didn't have any emotions other than curiosity. And the only sense I had was a vision. And so as soon as I started to feel that curiosity and wanting to know what was going on growing, I felt a tug to my left, like something pulled me towards the left. And I resisted it because I wanted to know what was going on. And it pulled again, and it pulled a little harder. And so I just relaxed into, okay, like clearly you want me to go somewhere. I don't know what you are or what this was. And there was no thinking involved. It was just complete, like utter, like full on in the moment presence. And I was, again, just pure consciousness. And so I just relaxed and it took me. And it took me through the wall into this bright white flash of a space. And then through another little opening, which was sort of like a whitish gray sort of round opening. And on the other side of it, where I just was like almost like reemerged, like dunked back into the particles that I was. But this space was much denser, and I was moving just imperceptibly fast in this space. And I could still see, and I didn't sense the movement, but I turned to my left and I looked, and the particles were there. I could see them. And then on occasion, there would be a space where there was a fluid like mixture of gray, white, black, and then it would turn back into the dense particles. And I saw that and I turned and I looked forward again, and then I just stopped. And immediately there was a almost like a funnel shaped download of information. And it was, and the only way I can describe it is that it was as if all of the questions I'd ever had in my lifetime were answered. And they all boiled down to one answer, and that was love. And so this information sort of funneled down, and then right in front of me was that point of love. And it was like all encompassing. It was everything, and I could feel it, and I could feel I was it. And So that feeling expanded infinitely outward. And it was this complete bliss, and even bliss doesn't touch it. So, you know, Sam Parnia had contacted me about taking part in a study that he was doing. And he was trying to nail me down as to like try to describe what you experience, but don't use the common descriptive words. And it was literally impossible for me to do that. And I quoted Joseph Campbell. I had heard say this. He was quoting like the ancient Hindu texts, I believe, where they describe the infinite, that infinite reality, as there no tongue has soiled it. Like there are no words to put to it. It was an experience, pure experience. So here I am, this all-encompassing eternal, which is beyond eternal, infinite, which is beyond infinity, love. And I turned to my right a bit because I saw this white light off in the distance. It was like a speck, but I could feel it wanted me to come to it. So I started moving in that direction. And as I moved toward it, it became bigger and became sort of like another opening that was a whitish gray. And there were shadow beings in the opening. And there was the shadow being of a little boy in the front. And I likened him to what I perceive to be, like, now in my humanness, a little Tom Sawyer, because he had a sort of a gray, again, like shadowy hat, round brim hat and overalls. And then there were adults behind him, flanking him and behind him. And he wanted my help and I wanted to help him. So I moved into this space. And as I moved in deeper into it, the shadow beings all sort of fanned out. And the little boy, I couldn't locate him. And I could feel that all of these adult shadow beings also wanted my help. And I wanted to help them all. I felt back to them. I want to help. Yes, I want to help you all. So they started to come at me like one by one. They dart at me and dart away and dart at me and dart away. And it was like all directions. And what they were doing was they wanted my energy. So they were taking my energy and I was starting to diminish in that space. And I could feel myself like very rapidly just diminishing. And I felt, no, I don't want this. So I was pulled out of there. And it was as if the universe was answering my feeling, my desire for myself, and helping me to sort of achieve this experience in this other realm. When I was pulled out of there, I was back into the dense particulate matter. And then very quickly, another opening came about, and it was the same particulate matter, and again, a round one. And I went through it and I emerged to this gorgeous landscape where there were yellow flowers out in front of me and green rolling hills dotted with trees behind that and a blue sky. And then to my right, there was this dark evergreen forest. And to my left, there was a waterfall with rocks covered in moss. And it was a gorgeous, I call it my Eden, because it was just perfect. And it felt perfect. And I merged with all of it. I merged with the flowers and the trees and the water and the rocks and the sky, the grass, all of it. I was it. And it was me. And again, this pure bliss state that I was in, I could have existed there eternally and been perfectly happy. And I was flanked on both sides then by these two beings. They were beige in color and like very tall and drapey sort of garments, but indistinct, and they didn't have faces. I could feel them and they communicated to me, you could stay here, you could go to what is beyond this, or you could go back. I felt like they unconditionally loved me and supported me and were there completely for me. And they would, like, it was my choice, whatever I wanted to do. I didn't have a sense of what came next, And I didn't know what I would be going back to because I didn't have any memory of being a human. And I, without knowing why, I decided I wanted to go back. So I started moving backwards, and I could see them through this opening, and they sort of turned and faced me in the opening and communicated as I was moving backward. They communicated, if you go back, you need to share what you learned here. And I said, okay, or felt back, okay. And the next thing that I was aware of was a terrible pain in my chest and waking up in the ICU. I didn't know where I was. I didn't have any immediate recollection of my experience. But I vehemently wanted to go home, to my home. And I looked and I tried to get out of the bed, and I was tethered down because I had an IV and blood pressure cuff and the rails of the bed were up. So I took the IV out. I unconnected it somehow. I took off the blood pressure cuff and I climbed over the railing of the bed, and there was a curtain there. And I remember my feet hitting the ground and me thinking that was very unstable, and them kind of wobbling a little bit, and then me waiting until I got my bearings. And then I flung the curtain open and my entire family was out just outside the ICU doors. And what had happened was my now ex-husband, he had been, you know, it had, was 36 hours after my daughter was delivered by emergency C-section. And I coded for 8 minutes, meaning I didn't have any heartbeat and I wasn't breathing. And they had been able to bring me back and they put me in the ICU. They intubated me for 36 hours. They had just extubated me and were starting to decrease the pain medicine. It was pain medicine and it was like a sedation. It was a medically induced coma. They were starting to decrease that medicine, and I was sleeping, and the nurses were making a lot of noise. And my ex-husband got very upset and yelled at them and tried to explain to them that I was trying to rest and they were preventing me from resting because I would be moving around and restless. And he knew that they were disturbing me. So my family took him out, and I must have woken up, you know, into this. So once they saw me standing there, I still remember my dad's head popping up and him just looking at me, and I heard him go, whoa. And they were all on me, the nurses, everybody, getting me back into the bed, telling me I needed to stay there. And I was just frustrated. And I'm like, I just want to go home. I just want to go home. And up until that point, they didn't know if I would be quote unquote a vegetable for the rest of my life. They didn't know what kind of brain function I would have. They had no clue what part of Krista would be coming back into her life after this event. And that showed them that I was still there. I had some some understanding of, you know, of at least where I wanted to be. So they moved me out of the ICU into a private room then. And I very, very like gradually recovered each day. I sort of became a little bit more aware of what was going on. I had severe short-term memory issues, some long-term memory issues. I didn't recall I had been pregnant. I didn't recall PA school, although I had just graduated 3 weeks before, passed my boards, everything. Didn't care about any of that. They had to tell me repeatedly that I had had a daughter. And then 5 minutes later, I would be asking, did I have twins? Did I have a boy? I thought my ex-husband now, I thought he was a volunteer at the hospital because he was always there. And so it was, they were concerned. They were concerned about what was going to happen to me in the future. But I finally met my daughter when she was 6 days old. She was taken from the hospital and brought to another hospital that had a NICU. And they had cared for her there. And then they brought her to me on the sixth day. And it was as if I had met her before. I held her and I knew her. And it was, I can't even just put words again just to describe that feeling of holding her and seeing her for the first time. But externally, my face was completely without emotion. And my family was really worried about how I would do as a mom. But internally, I felt that they could all feel how I was feeling, because that's how it was in my experience, although I didn't recall my experience yet. And I continued to feel that way. I didn't see a need for talking, because I felt like everyone could feel what I was, you know, thinking, feeling, whatever. That's how we communicated, was through feeling. So yeah, so that was the gist of the experience. And the experience itself came to me some weeks later as I recovered from the cardiac arrest. It's almost like layers of an onion were being peeled away. And I would wake up in the morning and I would feel a little bit more like the old Krista, because I was completely different when I came back. Before that, I was very type A, very science oriented. I was very focused on my career and then being a mom. And I had gotten married during PA school. But coming back, I was the opposite. I had no current concerns, no worries, no anxiety. Everything was good. Everything was perfect. And there was nothing to worry about. I acted on instinct. I intuitively knew what to do with my daughter. I flowed. That worried everyone very much.
They were worried that you were doing such a good job. That worried them.
They were worried that I was not the old Krista. That they were worried that I had had brain damage and that I was somebody else now. And they really wanted the old Krista, because that would reassure them. That would make them feel better. And I was perfectly happy in my own, you know, body space, my own mind. Although I tended not to think a lot. I just acted on instinct, impulse.
Would the doctors say that your recovery is much better than expected? Almost like, we can't see how you've recovered so well when you no oxygen in your brain for 8 minutes, or something like that.
Yes, they were very cautious in the beginning, and then as I progressed, they were very happy and relieved, and just told my family, just keep an eye on her. You know, they didn't give me any specific follow up or anything, but when I did reach out to my obstetrician, who responded to the code and delivered Maggie. He described that two miracles happened that day, that I was a miracle in that I survived and that I was able to pick up my career and go with it. And Maggie was the second miracle, that, you know, she came out, she was delivered, there's an Apgar score that's given to infants when they're delivered. It goes from 0 to 10. And she had an Apgar score of 1. She had a heart rate of 60. She was blue, flaccid, not breathing. And they revived her and brought her back. And for me, it was an amniotic fluid embolism that they suspect caused my lung vasculature to basically get clogged up. The plumbing was clogged. And therefore, I wasn't getting any oxygen in my lungs. That caused my heart to stop beating. And I arrested, and they performed CPR on me for about a minute. And then they had to stop compressions for approximately 90 seconds to 2 minutes to deliver my daughter, because I was bleeding profusely. And that's something that can happen after an amniotic fluid embolism, and it's called DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulation, where your body can't clot your blood. And so I was hemorrhaging. And so they stopped compressions. And I just laid there on the table when they delivered her. And when they were able to get the bleeding under control, they then resumed compressions and got my heartbeat back at the 8-minute mark. So they and then I spent about 2 days in the, or a day and a half to 2 days in the ICU, and I was transfused about 4 units of blood during that time. And of course, they're running all sorts of other tests. They checked my head. I had ultrasounds done and EEG. And everything was normalizing. They didn't find anything significant on the brain scans. My EEG didn't show anything out of the ordinary. So they were hopeful that my brain function was going to be okay, but they couldn't say for sure until they brought me out of the induced coma. And then, yeah, my OB, he confirmed everything, and he just said, "My life changed that day. Like, you and Maggie changed my life."
When you were out of your body at the beginning of the experience and you looked down and watched stuff happening, was he the guy that you confirmed stuff with? And almost like he could say, you couldn't have seen that. You were unconscious.
Well, yeah, he didn't come out and say that to me. Like, you couldn't have seen that because you were unconscious. I think it's just kind of implied. But I confirmed who was there. It was my OB, his partner showed up. He's the one who walked in the door and then walked up to the table. And he showed up as my OB was starting to, you know, he had handed Maggie over to what I found out was a nurse anesthetist who revived her. And he started to close me up as they were trying to get the bleeding under control. And that's what his assistant helped with. And then there was a cardiologist that showed up, and he was putting a catheter in my chest. And I saw that going on. And I actually met with him later because I had to get some cardiac testing done to make sure my heart was okay. And his partner, his boss, basically came in the room when I was there. And he said, my partner helped save your life. And I said, "Yes, I know. I saw." And he thought that was interesting.
When you were above your body, you felt this pulling, like something pulling you away, and then you wouldn't go, and then it pulled even harder. And in the book, you said it felt like it was almost saying, "I recommend you go with me."
Yes. It's like, no, you really need to go. It's kind of like the parent that's telling the child, "Okay, it's time to clean your room." And the child's like, "Oh, just 5 more minutes." Like, no, you really need to do it now. And the kid's like, "Okay, I know I need to do it now or I'm going to get in trouble." So they start doing it. It's kind of like that. It was like, okay, I need to go. I didn't know what I was going to or what for. I didn't have any sense of that, but I just intuitively knew, okay, I'm going. And it was as if, and I only in integrating the experience years later, I was able to put words to it, but it was as if I created my NDE and co-created it with the greater universe, with the benevolent source that is all. And that there were forces involved, and the force of love, that energy of love, and the force of what is termed here law of attraction. It was as if like I had a desire for something, and that's what fueled the experience, like the next part of it or whatever. So yeah, like I kind of boiled it down to two forces, the law of attraction and love.
My book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon. I've gathered accounts where something happened that could be checked, verified in the real world, details seen and heard when a person was, by all medical standards, gone. I wanted to focus only on those cases where there was evidence, not just stories. The book has had over 50 five-star reviews worldwide, this one from the United States. I have read more than 25 books and watched countless videos, and this book still had new stories. I love the fact that it focused on only verifiable experiences. This is an easy read and great for those needing proof. If you're searching for careful documentation, honest accounts, and stories that may just shift your understanding of life and what may follow, I invite you to read Verified Near-Death Experiences. Verified Near-Death Experiences is available on Amazon, on paperback, audiobook, and on Kindle. You had a quite distressing part of the experience, but there was a boy. And do you think that boy was like bait to get you to come in there?
Yeah, you know, it's always interesting to me how people interpret that part of my experience, because I had no fear or distress at any point. That was never something that I experienced. It was all either neutrality or love and like bliss and perfectness. In that space, you know, Lee Whitting, he and I spoke about it, and he put a word to it. He called it, it was sort of like a bardo space. And I think it's probably closest to that. These beings, they served a purpose. They served a purpose for me because they presented a scenario where I had the decision to choose me or to choose giving up me to others. And I chose me. And I needed to learn that then, at that point in my life, in my career, where I was able to forego the needs of others when I had my own needs that I needed to focus on and fulfill. And so that was a lesson. And I had a psychic friend of mine sort of explain it. Like, she's like, you were checking in with the universe, like helped you to create this scenario where you were just kind of checking in with your higher self. Like, hey, Krista, here you are. How are you on this path, on this aspect of your path? You good? Okay. So now you can go back and do your work, because you will take care of yourself through it.
So do you think those beings that were there were almost play acting because the lesson was set up, or they don't even exist, or they were lost souls?
I feel like they do exist on some level, you know, like level of what's the word? It's so hard to find words sometimes. Level of being, of existence, of energy, because there are other levels, there are other realms, you know, that vibrate differently than this one, that we travel to every night, but during the day too, often, and so yeah, so they helped me out. They were like performing a service. Is the sense that I had of it. And I had sort of summoned them into being to be there for me, to help me to check in and see where I was with my higher self.
Do you feel that everything you experienced was set up by you in some way? Like that place you said that was Eden?
Oh, 100%.
I don't know. Do you think it came out of your subconscious? It's not like you were thinking, right, I'm going to put a tree over here and I'll have a river over there.
It, you know, there are powers, forces that exist that within us and outside of us and for us that we have no comprehension of in this human form. And yes, they were, all of it was an orchestration. And all of it was to support Krista in this body, in this life, doing what she does each day. And I can tell you that as far as the nature theme, it's a reinforced or already pre-existing understanding within myself, where I have always had that innate connection to nature. And that was a sort of a solidification or a strengthening of it, that experience of being the flowers, literally being the flowers and being the trees and being the water and rocks and sky and grass and all of it. It was blissful, completely blissful. So coming back here and being in the body, in the life, I have a feeling, a depth of feeling of connection with nature that is, again, ineffable. I can't put words to it. There's a communication, there's a connection, and I thrive on it. And it's mutually supportive. And beyond this physical experience.
And I can hear you looking for words to describe it. That's what they say. People with near-death experiences, it's almost indescribable.
Yes, it is. Because the human word is the human word. It has limitations.
Do you feel that while you were there, you were in spirit form, you were more soulful, and that perhaps you were a lot more intelligent than you are right now?
And you know, it's funny because being the Krista that I was back then, very science focused, science oriented. And then in my NDE, I saw myself as particulate matter. I find it humorous. I think, you know, the universe definitely has a sense of humor. And so that was again a creation where, so that I could connect to it in the way that I was meant to connect to it. I could describe it in the way that I was meant to describe it to others. The experiences, it's my understanding, and others may have a different understanding. That's why I always preface everything, pretty much everything I say about this, is this is my experience. NDEs are as individual as a fingerprint. We try to lump them together and group them and say, you know, the research shows that there's these 10 criteria of NDEs, and which I find humorous because they are so individual. Yes, there's some common themes, and that's for the person who requires there to be common themes in order to understand them or to say, yeah, okay, that happened, that's plausible, whatever. But for the experiencer, it's like, this was my experience. It was meant for me, and it has themes that were meant for my, to help me to go in the direction that my life is meant to go in here. That I manifested once again in the physical to fulfill. And it's okay if other people don't understand it or they find it implausible. It's beautiful when people are touched by it and it helps them somehow in their life to bring some ease to whatever they may be facing.
Do you feel that the guides that were there that gave you the choice about returning, that perhaps they worked with you in constructing that environment?
They helped to construct it as well. It was a mutual effort between Krista's higher self and the universe, God, source, spirit, whatever you want to put a name to it, that greater consciousness that is everything.
And do you feel that perhaps it was part of the plan that you'd have a near-death experience, perhaps some years ago or maybe even before you were born?
Yes, yes. It's interesting because I had some precognition. The night before I went to the hospital, I had journaled. And I had written down kind of as an offshoot on a piece of paper, on the paper, I wonder who will visit me in my dreams tonight. And looking back, I just found that journal again and showed it to my husband. And it brought back that feeling of like, yeah, like it was pre-planned and I stepped into it with full knowledge. And therefore, you know, none of it was a mistake. The doctors, the nurse midwife, you know, the decision-making going up to having an induced delivery, all of it was purposeful. And I do feel like I helped to design it before I came here into this world the first time.
Yeah, it's like your higher self and those guides, those beings, they know you so perfectly. They knew exactly what environment to give you and what lessons you needed to learn.
Yes, isn't it gorgeous?
So you're in that place and you had the download and you kind of say that it answered all the questions you've ever had. But do you remember any of that?
I laugh because no, what it came to was that there were a lot of things that were confirmed within me, like the feeling that everything happens for what we call a reason, that there are no mistakes. But what I have discovered over the years is that what comes to me as intuition, as I call it sometimes clairsentience, where I have a deep understanding / knowing / knowledge of a situation that has either started to play out or that I foresee as playing out in the future. And then it comes to be that that's exactly what happens. Now, the question becomes for me, did I create that reality? Or was it that I was picking up on it and it was already in the process of creation? And that leads us back to the idea of time and space. And in this realm I was in, there was no time or space. There was no conception of either. It was eternal, vast. I mean, all the words that we try to describe a thing that cannot be described. But time itself didn't exist. And I find here that time is an abstract concept to me. I have a big challenge in taking part in that idea of time.
But when you were having the experience and there's no time, so did it feel like it was all happening in one moment? Because when you described it earlier, you were saying this happened and then this happened and then this, but It wasn't actually like that.
Yeah, it sounds like it's linear, but that's not what it felt like. it's challenging. But there was a succession of events, and that I don't really know how to describe it, but time was suspended.
There's not much more you can say, really, I suppose.
I don't really know how to describe it.
Didn't you wake up, soon after you woke up, you had a premonition of who you would work for and you told someone?
I did. Yeah. And that's, yeah. And, you know, it's so sweet because what I said was, when they got me back in the bed after I climbed over the railing and all that, and they were settling me back in, the nurse was at the end of the bed and she had bent over. I saw her and she had bent over. And as she was bending over, I said, because I was angry, I was mad. I felt like I was a prisoner in that hospital. And I said, I am a physician assistant, because we've changed our name now. We're physician associates. But I'm a physician assistant and I'm going to be working for Dr. Robert Ford. And that was the truth. I had been hired by the physician I had done a rotation with. And I was due to start in like the following, you know, I was going to be home with Maggie for 3 months and then I was going to start working. And she stood up and looked at me and her eyes were big as saucers. And she just said, okay. And she went and she wrote it in quotes in my chart. And it just so happened, this is a kind of a small town, that the physician who showed up to help my doctor close was a good friend of the doctor I was going to be working for. And that got back to the doctor that I was going to be working for, that I said that. And he never said anything to me until I brought it up. And I had gone to get my records and I had stopped into the office because I wasn't yet working. And I had Maggie, you know, I was carrying her in her little carrier, and I had my records in my hand, and I walked in and I said, Bob, look at what I said. And I could tell he already knew, but he couldn't tell me he already knew because confidentiality. But he just had a big smile on his face. Like, wow, you remember that at that point in your recovery. You know, it was pretty miraculous.
Well, there's another point in your experience I wanted to ask you about, because in the book, while you were in that sort of space of Eden, you say you turned your attention to a forest and felt darkness emanating from it. So what was that about?
Yeah, it was as if like there was something to be learned in that forest, but it wasn't time to learn it. And it was a lesson, and it was going to be a challenge. It was going to be difficult, arduous, possibly. And I can only say that being back here in this world and having those words to describe it, being in it, it was like, nope, don't want that. Very light, very like, nope, don't want that.
That's interesting. Wondering what that's all about. But could we for a moment talk about your husband and his near-death experience? What happened there?
Yeah. So my husband is Ainsley Threadgold. He had an experience when he was 13 years old. He was hit by a car while he was out delivering newspapers one evening. And so the car was going, they estimated about 40 miles an hour, and hit him, sending him flying into a ditch. He then was in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, in pain. And he said that he sort of passed out, or he's not sure what happened, but his dead grandfather came to him and sat down on the bed and held his hand and reassured him everything was going to be okay. And then he had an experience in what we call the afterlife, the realm that he traveled to And he had a whole experience there. But he didn't recall it until many years later. He as the 13-year-old, he woke up in the hospital and he had a full, like, up to his hip waist cast on his left leg. He had broken it, the leg below the knee, in multiple fragments, multiple places. And it just so happened that there was a specialist, an orthopedic specialist, giving a lecture at the hospital that day, who they were going to amputate his leg. And he said, no, let me look at him. And he actually manipulated it and they were able to save Ainsley's leg. So he had had a watch that his parents had just given him not long before that first birthday, and it had broken in the accident. Well, right after he got home from the hospital, his parents bought him another watch, and it worked for about 15 minutes and then it stopped working. So they bought him another one. The same thing happened. And fast forward many years, he ends up going, he has sciatica symptoms on the left leg, left side. He goes to an osteopath and he asked him, you know, what sort of problems have you had before? And Ainsley told him about the car accident, and they got, somehow it got around to, I can't wear watches anymore. And the doctor started to question him more about that, and then handed him Penny Sartori's book on near-death experiences and said, you might find this interesting. So he read Penny's book and said he found himself in her book. He's like completely intrigued. So he went to a forensic hypnotist, regressionist, and his entire near-death experience came back to him. It was as if he was experiencing it all. It was happening in real time. And that led him to the most local chapter of IANS in Manchester, where Kelly Walsh was. And at the same time, I was reaching out to Penny to see who her publisher was, because I wanted to find a publisher for my book. And she answered my email and directed me to Kelly as well. And so I reached out to Kelly, and Kelly and I connected. Her and Ainsley had become friends. And then Ainsley and I met through Kelly.
So you said your husband had problems with watches there, and this is an after effect that we see, isn't it? Do you have any after effects?
I personally don't notice a lot of after effects. Other than this heightened awareness, understanding of energy, I have, and intuitive abilities, the clairsentience. I navigate my life by it. That's how I function in my life, make decisions, conduct myself, is really through all of that, through energy. This connects, this deep, again, ineffable connection to all that is. And it's what I am. It's what all of us are. But we all have the ability to connect that deeply without having to die.
And did you say that you thought COVID happened for a reason?
Well, it's a far longer sort of discussion, but COVID was a moment in earthly time where humanity sort of needed a jump start in consciousness and awareness, in growing in greater awareness. Simultaneously, while this is a wonderful, beautiful thing, simultaneously, the forces that are present were doing what they do. And So it's sort of this balanced counterplay between the dark and the light. But COVID was sort of a catalyst for so many to quote unquote wake up from the dream that we were all in, and move humanity forward in growing awareness and growing greater consciousness and connection. Well, again, simultaneously, these other not so nice forces are also allowed to exist. And all of it ultimately is a return to love.
It's been great talking to you. The book's called I Died and Learned How to Live, and people can get that on Amazon?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. Yep.
And do you have a website?
I do have a YouTube channel. It's at Krista Gorman. So people can certainly navigate themselves there. And you can always reach out to me by email at 12principles@gmail.com.
Great. Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Simon. It's been great talking with you.
This week, I was talking to Krista Gorman about her book, I Died and Learned How to Live. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you get access to the extended episodes. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions, and you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out now on Amazon, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.